if you're going to be looking for these spots to get more aggressive, one of the points of Decade is to just turn your brain off and make emotionless decisions. You literally cannot write a rule that defines divot that can be equitably enforced across 35 groups across 200 acres. It can't be done. The reason that you should agree with me is you seem like a nice guy. I assume you're not a cheater.
Yeah,
especially if you're like, just move an inch or two. Guess what? There are cheaters out there.
There is a podcast brewing that's about to take over podcasting for good. The only podcast that you are going to need to tune into day in, day out, is the Member Guest Podcast.
If I can hit it down the middle of the fairway, that's great. But again, with the driver right now, the driver sucks.
John Daly, and you're listening to the Member Guest Podcast. Rip it.
All right, Mr. Scott Fawcett, I was pumping your tires in my email to you because your episode is still our number one most listened, most viewed, and we still have a podcast a little over a year later, so we're doing something right on our end, and it's good to have you back. I'd like to catch up, see what's going on. And I mentioned I got my club championship this weekend. So pick your brain on a couple holes too.
Yeah. For what he's saying for the listeners, we had to pass off yesterday a couple times. We had it scheduled and he was trying to punt it to next week maybe. And I was like, well, if you've got your club championship this weekend, this might help you as much as anything. So that's one of the things I love about podcasts is typically a lot of the people, they like Tim Ferriss. He's just like, I'm not doing this for y'all. I just want to talk to these people. And if it helps you too, then I assume it will. So looking forward to seeing what we can do to help you.
That's how all great like founders and CEOs say that they started out, right? You grew something big. So it's just helping other people and you're passionate about it. So I wanted to kick off before we started. I mentioned I live really close to Hazeltine. I play there a lot. And I saw you talking about obviously the USAM a little bit. And the question popped into my head. I imagine the answer is going to be no, but I'm still going to ask it. Does strategy or decade change at all in match play?
It doesn't. I mean, this is where it's hard for people to really understand. You make basically all of your birdies on par fours that aren't drivable-ish via variance, like once you're playing the game correctly. And so when people ask me, should I deviate from strategy, what that typically means is should I get more aggressive on my approach shots? And that answer, I mean, again, off the tee, that's already set in stone. Your putting is what it is. When someone's saying, should I get more aggressive? That is essentially always asking for their approach shots. And no, you shouldn't. I mean, again, your shot pattern is just so big and so variable that even by playing by correct strategy, so let's say you're 140 yards and the pin's four from the right, a difficult pin position like you'd get in the US Amateur, we want you aiming several yards left of that pin, towards the middle of the green, not all the way to the middle of the green, but towards the middle of the green. And typically, again, that also has caveats to it also, but you will have a slightly longer birdie putt on average, but you'll have more of them. And even beyond that, the chip shots that you will have from the short-sided side will also be shorter than getting it over there dead. So, I mean, you'll have a slightly longer birdie putt on average, but you'll have more of them. I mean, that's literally why the birdie rates don't change. And it's just so interesting because now that we've got so much data from the Decade app, your scoring averages clearly drop more by avoiding bogey than by making more birdies. And that's even on an individual hole-by-hole basis. Now, the one, again, caveat to that is if you have a somewhat drivable par four or a somewhat reachable par five that entails a bunch of penalty hazards, you can get very aggressive off the tee and very aggressive on your second shot on par fives. And you will make more birdies by doing that. You will also make more bogeys and higher, but it's the one place where you really won't destroy your scoring average by getting more aggressive. So you will increase variance, which is what you want to do in that scenario. You want to increase variance, which means making more birdies and more bogeys without completely destroying your scoring average. And so that's why you saw like Bobby Massa on 16 hitting driver, because he can get up there to 50 yards from the green and he's going to make a lot more birdies from 50 yards than he is from 130 or 40. And so his overall scoring average likely would not change much. And then that's where, you know, with the decade decision tree, what I tell people off the tee all the time is if you've got a hole where like any of the there's like multiple club choices off the tee that kind of make sense, your scoring average likely is basically the same. You're just increasing variance the longer you go off the tee. And so, no. And one other thing I'll add to that is, if you're going to be looking for these spots to get more aggressive, one of the points of decade is to just turn your brain off and make emotionless decisions. And the more you are trying to find spots to get more aggressive, the more you're going to deviate. So even if there was a spot that you made a correct decision to get more aggressive, you're going to have to be looking for that spot constantly, which is exhausting. And I also do believe that for every one good deviation you make from proper strategy, you're going to make four incorrect ones for a net loss. So I firmly believe, and that's one thing Stuart Sink said when he won for the second time after buying the Decade app. He was just like, man, it just makes the decisions for me and it keeps me fresh at the end of the day. And I never really would have thought about how much mental energy is wasted just making decisions. And, you know, because most of my golf over the last 10 years has been just caddying for Zalatoris or Doc Redman or just, you know, a couple of different guys on tour. And so I'm not playing, I'm just thinking and walking. But when you're kind of doing both, which is what most of your listeners are doing during golf tournaments, most of your listeners, I assume, aren't, you know, having caddies out there in golf tournaments.
Yeah, so yeah,
it's just hard to do both. It's hard to think and hit shots. And just, it's just, it really is, again, considering golf is such a laid back sport, it's really taxing mentally if you're just constantly running all these different iterations of where you stand to par, what you are on the leaderboard, where you stand in your match. Just play golf and see what happens.
Yeah, I don't want to deviate too far from, because I do want to ask some more questions about the USAM, and I imagine you have a lot of you know, clients and stuff that use Decade out there. But since you kind of brought it up, I saw a clip of you talking about, somebody asked you the question on, is analytics taking over golf like it did baseball? And is that for better, for worse? And I'm curious to hear your answer again. Like it is and it has, but like to what extent? Because I still, like, when I watch and I listen, right, to, you know, commentators, announcers, they seem to kind of to throw it all out the door, right? Yet. Yeah, it hasn't taken them over. And I don't think it's taken over the general golf fan, right? Like it has maybe for players and for elite level AMs and whatnot, but for kind of, you know, the rest of golf, I'm not sure it has. So I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, the difference in golf and baseball is, in baseball, they're using analytics to build a team. Now, obviously, they're also doing in-game strategy modifications, but the vast majority, like the original Moneyball, was simply building a team out of analytics. And I would say the analogy to that is strategy of golf is entirely based on analytics now. And what's interesting is, The strokes gained, and they're all great, but for the most part, most people are just fractionally worse at everything than they want to be. I mean, yes, you have a strength and a weakness, but it's not like it's three standard deviations, you know, in one category versus another. So I really, honestly, with the tour players that I work with, I use data far more often to prove to them they're not bad at something than I do to tell them what to work on. And again, the confidence that you get in people, again, they'll look at, oh, my 5 foot make rate's terrible. And I'm like, well, that's going to be sample size. Because look, your 4 and 6 foot make rates are above average. So if we look at 4, 5, and 6 foot together, you're actually above average. And they, you know, again, the guys just get really mental about, they think that everyone else is doing something they're not. And again, the main thing that I think data, Mark Brody is obviously far smarter than me, the guy that created strokes gained, but he's a, you know, Ivy League business professor. He's looking for statistics when he created it to help explain why people are good at what they are. As a former playing professional, when I realized what he did, the obvious application to me was to optimize strategy. And so we just have, because of our backgrounds, a different slant on what to use the data for, but I firmly believe that using it for strategy is far more important. I mean, again, I'm not a big baseball fan, and I think that most people would think like the game of baseball can't evolve anymore or whatever. But my understanding is just from Instagram clips that guys are now, when they know they're going to be forcing a double play, are just overrunning second base. I mean, because you're going to get there faster by running. So they're kind of sacrificing either the guide first or themselves to turn fewer double plays. And again, I might be completely wrong on how I'm phrasing that, but it seems like there are things they keep on learning that are like, yeah, well, that's actually the way to do it. And that's, you know, what golf is essentially doing now.
So why haven't, why haven't the commentators, is like the facade?
I have no
idea. Is it the facade of like, we need to, you know, kind of have the everyday watcher, you know, make it look like these pros are just above and beyond any capabilities of anybody else out there. And they're firing at a flag and they're going right at it. And they're going to hit it, you know, 90% of the time, when all of us know on the analytical side, that's just incorrect, right? Like,
I don't understand it. I really don't. One of the things you're referring to is Hideki in Memphis last week. He's got a one shot lead. He's got a, I think, an 8-iron into the green, and he hits it to 5 feet left of the pin over by the water. Like, there's just literally zero chance that's where he's aiming. I mean, there's zero chance that's where he's aiming. So the announcer media was just like, God, I mean, here's a guy just firing on all cylinders. He steps up there with a 3-wood and hits a draw down the fairway and then fires right at the flag. It's like, well, the 3-wood is a club that they draw more often because the ball's further back in their stance and they're hitting down on it more. And what's the alternative? Hit a cut over the water so they get to drop it on the tee? Like, it just literally makes no sense. The commentating on that one made absolutely no sense. Of course you would want to play a draw on that particular shot. And then to say that just because of where the ball went, that that's where he was aiming, it's just a fundamental lack of understanding of shot patterns and variance. Because what I said in my Instagram post was, if you think that that's where he hit it intentionally, then you also have to think that every time they hit it in the water, that that's where they were trying to hit it.
Yeah,
you can't,
exactly.
You just can't think of wherever the ball finished, that's where they were trying to put it. And the main thing whenever I make posts like that, and the comments in it, they'll always say it a few times, yeah, but it's not as dramatic of a story. I think that's just one of those things we tell ourselves. I mean, it's the story's still the same. I mean, if the guy was tied and hit that shot, then it's a dramatic story to say like he fired right at it. But to not say that that was a pull, I don't understand it. I mean, at this point, obviously, I've got myself into trouble with enough announcers that they should. They're aware of Decade, every single one of them. I mean, Nobolo texts me all the time for some information. Chambly texts me all the time for information on certain things. But then your main on-air guys, I don't get it. I mean, again, it's not like they don't know what I do and know how these players are playing now. They just kind of refuse to. I don't know.
It's got to just be the you know, there's an aspect of TV and entertainment at the end of the day that, you know, they're trying to put out a product that people want to watch. And when you, you know, see a shot like that, or really in any scenario, it's really easy to just kind of disregard the process and the strategy behind it and just say, man, these guys are good. Like, look at what he just did in that presser pack moment. You know, not here's where we think he was aiming and all that stuff, right? It's probably entertainment value, I'd guess.
Again, I fully agree with you. That's the only plausible and reasonable explanation for why they don't, you know, just acknowledge it. But I'm just saying, I think that narrative is tired and old. They're at this point, they're making themselves look a little more foolish because the viewers educated enough at this point to know that's not what's happening. I mean, again, if you just look in the comments, I don't know how many comments there wound up being on that particular post, but there was a bunch, and all of them were along the lines of, that's the first thing I thought of. The first thing I thought of was you and Decade first. I mean, again, the viewers getting there, and I definitely agree it's time the announcer gets there.
Catches up. Yeah. So going back to the AM a little bit then, I think you were saying that it's Jose Luis. Is that what he goes by, or is it just Jose? Do you know?
I have no idea.
I'll just say Jose Luis then. It kind of looked like he was playing the bomb and gouge strategy, at least from what I
100%.
Saw. Like, yeah, I've played Hastings a few times. I think he had like a flip wedge in on one, which is just absolutely insane. With how long that rough was, I know some members out there, they said the rough by the time it got to the weekend of match play was like 8 inches long. And so my question
it
to you,
been that long because they couldn't have moved it, but it was,
yeah, okay,
it
so maybe,
was definitely, it
maybe
was
six
definitely
inches
bad.
Long.
It was definitely bad rough.
So
no
it,
doubt.
It brings in my next question. Like, when the rough is that long, does it make your decisions harder off the tee, right? Because
it makes it easier.
It makes it easier. You just need to pound it just as far because it's going to be easier to get out with the wedge than it will be a 7-iron.
100%. There's a reason the guys that made it to the quarters were all bombers. I mean, like, it's funny looking back at it, because when Tiger turned pro, the haters were saying, well, he'll never win the Grand Slam because he can't win the U.S. Open because of how long and air quotes erratic he hit it. Now, granted, he started hitting 70% of the fairways while also being the longest player on tour. But in hindsight, and again, with data, we now know that those are actually the easiest tournaments to win. If I could have placed a bet, we can't because we have to sign ethics clauses and I don't gamble on golf. But if we could have, I would have put every cent I own on Bryson to win at Winged Foot. I mean, I literally would have put every cent I own.
I did pick him to win.
Huh?
I said, I think I picked him to win.
It was such a no-brainer. It's ridiculous. And once whoever was that was like the group in front of or the second group in front of him and on the final round lost their ball on one because it was just getting so bad, I texted Como and I'm like, he's going to win by five. I mean, like, there is no chance away from a colossal choke. There's no chance he doesn't win this golf tournament today because, again, nobody's hitting fairways. And that's historically the truth of a U.S. Open is if nobody hits fairways, then I would take the guy that carries it the furthest every single time. And again, once Bryson is literally carrying it miles past everyone. I mean, so when they shut down for COVID, the first tournament back was Colonial. And Chris Como is one of my best friends. His, Como's indoor living room lab or whatever they call it is literally down the street from me. I had gone over there and watched Bryson hitting balls into the net while the pandemic was shut down. And you don't really get a perspective for what 195 mile an hour ball speed is into a net in a living room. But we went out together to watch the final round of Colonial. And I specifically just wanted to see where Bryson hit it on number 11, because it's a 600 and whatever yard par five that is dead straight away. So everyone in the field's hitting driver. Bryson was going to unleash on this one. And when he hit it, it was just comical. And he was 20. He flew it in the rough, which means he didn't get any roll. And Brooks was the second longest drive of the day, 20 yards behind him and in the fairway. So, like, he carried Brooks' final destination by 20. And I'm just like, and we get around to 14, which is a bit of a dogleg left. And, there's the other thing, too, is there's no one out there. The only people that out there had instructor credentials, the players and then the walking commentators, because there was no spectators. So it was really eerie, but it was also really cool. And Bryson hits this thing 1,000 yards left on this dog leg, which even I was like, surely that's left. And he hits it and the commentator, here we go, like, oh, that's pretty far left, Johnny, or whatever it was. And we're walking along and all of a sudden we see it land in the fairway. I mean, like, we've literally started walking and the ball is still in the air. I hear him say that and we see it land in the fairway. And he just looked at me like, are you kidding? And I'm like, dude, this is, again, I've said this before, but I think what he's doing is one of the most impressive things in all of sports history. I mean, aside from the steroid era in baseball, which is obviously not humanly possible because it requires steroids. What Bryson accomplished in changing his game, I just can't come up with a scenario that's the same where someone's completely changed their body, every aspect of their game, everything about it, and improved. I mean, people have tried it before, but they've not gotten better.
How much do we miss him on the PGA Tour? I think if there's one guy that's probably benefited the most from going away from the PGA Tour to live, it's got to be Bryson because of the extra rest days, probably a little bit less golf, gets to work on his strategy and stuff a little bit more. But I think, like, when Rahm left, I think a lot of people thought, man, like, Rahm's gone, this could be it. But in my opinion, it's like, it's Bryson, because Bryson is just the most fun to watch, like, pure entertainment value on Saturday and Sunday in the major championships. Like, people turn it on to watch Bryson hit a drive 360 yards.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny when Liv first happened and we lost Dustin and DJ and Brooks, which are two of my favorite players. Like, if you have me sit down and list my favorite, my top five, those two are in my top five. But I don't watch much golf. I don't really care. I mean, I think that would probably surprise people considering my job. I just literally don't watch it. I find it just exhausting. And the first tournament without them, I think, was the Players. And I was just like, oh, this kind of sucks. And I think we're seeing that more now. Like, there are 8 or 10 guys that would be great to have back on tour. I agree with you. Bryson has probably benefited the most. I don't know, man. It's just hard. It just sucks. And I wish they would figure out what they're going to do together. It's been over a year now since they made the announcement they're doing something, and like nothing's happened, which, you know, Greg Norman, he just hates the PGA Tour so much. I just can't imagine how they're going to budge enough to actually get something done. And he's so about Greg that I actually got a text last night from a friend saying that he's looking for a house to rent here in Dallas during the LIV Tour Championship. And they, you know, the guy was like, he sent me just a screenshot of the person that had gotten a hold of them saying he's looking for something super high end, super, you know, fancy, probably in the $25,000 range for the week. And I'm just like, you're coming in town for a week, man. All your parties are at places. I'm sure he's going to host stuff at night, but it's like just blowing in and wanting just a $25,000 house for the week. Just, I mean, Norman's just,
money's not an object to him at this point. Feels like it's just his ticket against the tour.
100%. And this is what's cracked me up, certainly over the last year or two, saying that the Saudis won't just fund it to infinity. And I'm like, yes, they will. They've sunk billions of dollars into this already. They're not going to abandon. And then I saw something, I don't know how accurate it was, but I think a soccer player basically just got $1 billion in the last couple of weeks to go play in the Saudi soccer league. Like they have more money, I think, than anyone can possibly fathom. And it's like, if you only have $1 million, giving away $1 million is a lot of money. If you have 100 million, giving away $1 million isn't that big of a deal. If you have $1 trillion, a few billion, like you just don't even notice it. Like it's just literally irrelevant. And I think that that's probably more accurate as to how much money they're dealing with is in the trillion or trillions than hundreds of billions.
Yeah. Good luck competing with that when the business you're going against can just have a zero margin business and do whatever they want.
It doesn't matter. Like, yeah. They don't care if they sell tickets. Just open up the gates. Let anyone who wants to come on in. I mean, like, you're just the tours. I never would have thought the tour would be in trouble, but it's not good.
It's not good, but I had this combo with my buddy the other day. Like, if Rom can leave and people don't care, do they, at what point does it not really matter? Like, golf is one of those sports where it's more about the history and the accomplishments that you make. It is going to take years and years and years for LIV to ever catch up to anything even close to that, right? So, like, if a John Rahm can leave, like, I would argue, even if Scottie Scheffler left today, I don't think it would change golf that much. Like, they have too many up-and-coming guys that will inevitably, like, then Xander becomes the face, then somebody else becomes the face. You know what I mean? So, I don't know. That's just my two cents. I don't think there's any one golfer that's above the tour, except for, obviously, Tiger, you know, call it two decades ago.
Yeah. I mean, again, I just think it's I don't know why I've literally been saying this a ton lately for whatever reason, for whatever phase of life I'm in. But I think the hardest part about life is that you'll never know the counterfactual of any decision. You took door one, so you'll never know what was behind door two. And I think that's where we're at. We've now taken door one. So who knows? I mean, what would have happened if the tour, when Mickelson was first saying they've got all this money and they're not sure with the plan, I'm like, it's not like the commissioner can just write himself a check for $20 million. Now, granted, they can spend way too much money on a headquarters and do stuff like that. But I just was thinking to myself, there's just no way they've got all this money sitting around. And then all of a sudden they just find a couple hundred million to give away. And the tour, like, if they don't keep, and yeah, I'm way out over my skis here. I don't know what I'm talking about. So I feel like Joe Rogan, where he's like, don't listen to me. I'm a comedian. Even though I'm in the golf business, I have no idea what I'm talking about. But the tour does have limited resources. Now, granted, they have a ton of resources right now, but if they don't keep getting the TV contracts and title sponsors and everything else, they can't fund 7 elevated events for the next 30 years. Like, that's not how it works. The other people are, as you said, dealing with a zero margin business. Like, okay, we'll just keep going until you run out of money. And they will do that to them. The reason the tour, my understanding, has finally agreed to partner with them was the Saudis are like, we're just going to bury you in legal fees. I mean, that's all we're going to do is bury you in legal fees. So you have the choice of doing this or get your checkbook out. Do you want to just throw your money away or do you want to figure out how to do something? And at some point, it is what it is.
Yeah. Well, before we get to some of my club championship stuff, I do want to ask, I've obviously been following you for a while now, but what's your game been like? I remember you were you trying to qualify for the senior USAM? Is that what it was?
Oh, no, because I'm 51 now.
Oh, so you can't. You got amateur goal
starts at 55. I played in the U.S. Senior Open earlier this year. So last year, I turned 50 July 4th of 2023. And what sucks is I was playing really good. And then I tore a muscle in my calf to where I didn't play golf in August, September, or October. And so I've played like six times getting ready for Champions Tour Q School, which was the week after Thanksgiving. And I shot, I don't remember what I shot, but I missed going to final stage by one shot, which considering I essentially had not played golf in 4 months, it gave me a little bit of like, you know what? I can compete with these guys. And so I don't play winter golf. So I didn't touch my clubs for about 3 or 4 months. And then I decided the one thing I'm not doing well is hitting the ball lower. Like I've had surgery on both my elbows. I've got no forward shaft lean because I got to where I didn't take a divot for about 10 years because it just hurt. And so I decided at the start of this year, I was going to really try to work on, I haven't worked on my game in literally 10 years. I just typically play pretty good. I've been a pretty consistent plus five for the last 10 years without playing or practicing at all.
Hey, I'd take that right now, brother.
I mean, again, I laugh about it because I've just got a swing that it just does what it does. It's short, yes. It's compact, it's powerful. And it just, again, the point that I've done it 7 million times. So I knew going into trying to change my swing was going to be risky. But I really feel like to compete on the Champions Tour, I need to hit it lower. I mean, there's just going to be at least one day out of three that it's windy. And so I need to hit it lower. So I really put some effort into it. I shot 68 to qualify for the U.S. Senior Open while working on that stuff. But that's where it just all fell apart. The tight bent fairways up in Rhode Island, I just, with what I was working on, that just... It just was awful. I shot 75-75, which, again, to be perfectly honest, as a 51-year-old amateur, it's not like I'm embarrassed of that by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, I didn't finish last. I didn't make the cut, obviously, but I didn't finish last. And then I came home and I shot 83 the next weekend in a qualifier for our Ryder Cup deal at my home course. I haven't shot in the 80s in probably 30 years. And it was just this punch in the face of like, okay, that's not working. I took my kids to Disney for a week and then I came home and I was like, I'm just going to go back to no swing thoughts. I typically have a pretty weak lead grip. And one of the main things I was trying to do was strengthen that grip so I could get some flexion to lean the shaft. And I was like, I'm punting all that. And then I hit balls probably 4 or 5 times just, and I don't usually put AirPods in because I want to concentrate. I just put AirPods in with music. So I was just swinging. And I got to where I was hitting it pretty good. I played back-to-back rounds where I shot 72-74, but I had 5 and 6 birdies in those two rounds, which is usually an indicator something's starting to go right.
Yeah.
And then the next weekend, we had our Stableford deal at my club. And it's a very difficult golf course. Stonebriar here, just north of Dallas. It's a 75.5, 75.6 course rating. And I shot 63, which potentially is my lowest round relative to the course rating ever. So in a 2 week period, I shot 83 and 63, which is beyond comical. But now that this has now been a few weeks, I'm striping it. Like I've never hit it better. I mean, I would love to go back and see my game in my playing professional days in my 20s and compare it to what I'm doing right now. Like I went out and hit balls yesterday and I swear to God, every single shot is directly at the flag. Like it's honestly bizarre. And so I'm excited where I'm heading because right now my body feels pretty good. And so I've got a couple of months to try to work on my game again to try Champions Tour Q School again. So long story long on your question, I've literally gotten to where my putting sucks. I just joined this country club back in April. And if there's any one thing I've been disappointed in, the greens have been pretty slow. And so I just haven't bothered practicing my putting at all. I mean, I literally have not.
Slow greens can be tough, man. People think they're easier, but I think they're more unpredictable. And you just like the speed control on, you know, the 30 footers is way more difficult, in my opinion, than they are on like a running at a 12 or a 13.
It's a fine line, man, because it also just depends on what you're used to. So like I did my US Mid-Am qualifier a couple weeks ago at a place called Lakewood here in town. And I mean, I had like 33 and 34 putts the two rounds at the Senior Open. And so one would think, well, you would come home and probably work on your putting. I didn't work on my putting at all because the greens, first of all, they were punched for, well, you know, a week and a half. And then they were just slow recovering from that. And then I had my US Mid-Am qualifier where I shot 73, but I probably had 33 or 34 putts in that also, where my speed control is just so bad. And as I talk about all the time, I literally have a video in the app titled Putting is Easy. And and I believe it is, assuming you can actually work on and do the decade speed drills, which again, I just literally have not done. And that's where people are like, I thought putting was easy. I'm like, it is if you practice.
Yeah.
But if you don't practice.
It's really hard if you don't practice at all.
And then you show up at a place with super undulated greens rolling 12, guess what? You're probably going to suck at putting. And, you know, so it's a little frustrating because I went out there. I actually reset up. I moved into a new house back in April. I've got the good guys living in my old house. And this new house, I was planning on making this room a simulator, but then I was like, you know what? I've joined this club. I don't really need to spend $50,000 doing that. So I decided not to. But one of the things I did have in my old house was a pretty nice little putting studio setup with a 25-foot long well putt mat. I had a putting arc nailed down to the ground, and then I use an eyeline putting rod that goes into my chest. And I had not done that all year. And once I finally putted so bad again at Lakewood, I was like, okay, I need to at least set up in my garage. I've just got a strip of black duct tape that just runs for 20 feet. And then I've attached the putting arc to where it's in the same place. And I've actually used that, I mean, three or four times. And just what I've been going out to my course and rolling putts. Like, I think that I got into a habit where I was kind of moving up and out of it a little too much. And that rod just really helps you stay down and down in the putt. And I feel like my stroke has gotten a lot better. Again, I still haven't been able to work on my speed, but hopefully once they just punched him again this week. So hopefully once that clears up, I'll have 3 months of good runway to get after it.
Yeah. Get out there and practice. Atrocious. Practice. That's all you need.
Yeah, I mean, I just literally stand over a putt. I'm like, I have absolutely no reference point how hard to hit this putt. I mean, I've never felt quite as lost. But what I will say positively for myself is it's not yippy. Like I've had a yip before, and so I know what that feels like. It's not that. It's just a complete lack of practice.
Yeah, not being familiar. You can fix that pretty quickly. I'm pulling up Birdie Fire here. We're going to go over just a couple holes. I'll share my screen. But my last question before I do this, I know I keep saying I have one more question. But I saw your rant on the divots in the fairways and not able to figure out. Can you talk about this? Because this is actually one of... So let me take my stance, all right? Because I am going against you on this one. My stance is that you shouldn't be penalized for hitting the ball in the fairway. And in, you know, when it's rainy outside and you got lift cleat in place, like we already have that, like how is hitting it into clearly what is a divot, not able to move that, you know, even an inch behind or an inch to the left or an inch to the right of that set divot and just use common sense with the rules officials out on the course?
First of all, common sense isn't very common anymore. I don't disagree. Fair. You should have, it'd be great if you had a good lie. I don't disagree, but you also get bad lies that aren't in divots. And the most important thing is, you literally cannot write a rule that defines divot that can be equitably enforced across 35 groups across 200 acres. It can't be done. And the reason that I say that and the reason that you should agree with me is you seem like a nice guy. I assume you're not a cheater.
Yeah.
Especially because you're like, just move an inch. Guess what? There are cheaters out there. And those guys would abuse the rule, period. And so you actually are just opening the door to get cheated more often. And your response to that could be like, well, everyone in the group has to agree. How can different groups agree to a subjective thing of when is a divot stop being a divot? There's literally been a divot on every square inch of every fairway, probably at some point in time. And figuring out when that is done being a divot is the challenge in the rule. And what I've posted on Instagram, and I do believe this, even if let's say that you could write it in a utopian way, and we're going to play it up a scorecard length. You know, so you've got a very small area and we're going to play it up, placing it. If you think about this, the area of a square of a scorecard in all directions, there's a better chance of there being a divot in that area than there is of your ball being in a divot. And if that's the case, because people talk about collection areas all the time, well, how about if you get in a collection area that is thin, but you're not in a divot, and your opponent just happened to be in a divot, and now they can just set it on the lip of that divot and just hit a little nipped flop shot off of it, and you're stuck like, damn it, I wish I was in a divot so I could move this. You just can't do it. And so, again, the next thing people say is, oh, well, okay, rather than placing it, that makes sense, we'll drop it. Well, how big of a drop are we going to take? A scorecard length? Well, if the ball rolls outside of that, do you have to redrop it? How far can it roll? Because the typical rule is if it rolls outside of a club length, then you redrop it. If I've got a club length to work with, and that's what I showed in that video, this one par five in my home course, I was 20-ish yards behind it, and I could easily be stymied behind it. But then once I move it a club length off to the side, I just had a perfect line to the flag with a three iron. I think that it just introduces way, way, way more problems than how rare you're actually in divots. I mean, it's pretty rare. And I guess maybe I play at fairly nice places that have less play, I guess. I don't believe that's true either. But maybe some courses have a ton of divots. You just aren't in divots very often.
Yeah, I guess I feel like my issue with it is like there's so many rules in golf that get taken advantage of. Like it's just a rule in golf where
it's a thing. You use the rules to your advantage.
Yeah, like have like a sprinkler head in the rough is in your stance. Now you get a driver length. You get to put it in the fairway. Like I'm sorry, I just think that that's stupid. That you get improve your lie, right? But then you look at something like, man, I'm in a divot. How can I not move this a quarter inch to put it in the fairway? I think that's more along the lines of where I stand, Scott. Is not that. It's almost impossible to write the correct ruling for a fairway divot.
But you have to be able to write the correct ruling.
And that's the problem. And I think there's other rules that just make my head explode sometimes.
I fully agree with you. And the other problem is that most people don't realize is in a scenario with, you couldn't really do it with the sprinkler head drop that you're talking about, but like there's many scenarios where they say, hey, if you're in doubt, play two balls. You can't play two balls from a divot because you're going to make the divot bigger. And then it'll be like, oh yeah, obviously it was a divot. You can't play two balls in this scenario. And again, like I say, I don't disagree that it would be nice to not have to play from a divot, but it's unlucky if you get in a divot, but you're just introducing a different kind of luck that your opponent can take advantage of in certain scenarios. And you can't, I mean, again, like, if I've got a mini driver into a par five, I sure as heck would like to put my hand on the ball to get as good of a lie as possible versus playing it down. Yeah. I mean, and that just, again, I really believe.
Find a little piece of grass so you can kind of tee it up on or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it makes a huge difference. So again, I don't disagree, but the fact you can't define a divot, I mean, again, you just literally can't define it. That in and of itself, and then the fact that there's just too many other variables of luck you're introducing once you start playing it up. And again, the idea of playing it up everywhere, I think, is just a terrible idea. Like, that's just not golf. Like, part of it is rub of the green and being able to handle the emotions associated with it.
Yeah.
But again, this is the deal. Is like, that should just be tournament golf. That should just be tournament golf. If you and your buddies want to play it up, knock yourself out. I mean, again, because now we're just playing wolf and, hey, guys, we're going to be reasonable here with that's in a divot. Hey, kick it out. I mean, that's what me and my buddies do. It's just like, it's not like a stated rule between us. It's just like, if you see your buddy's ball in a divot, like, hey, take it out of that. Like, we're not playing tournament golf. Knock yourself out and do that. But tournament golf, again, just cannot, there's just, you can't write the rule, which is mandatory.
All right. Well, I know I got to get you out of here in like less than another 10 minutes.
No, you're good. I got plenty of time.
Well, I do know that you said you were going to practice today. So I want to be,
well, I'm going go to get sitting, actually.
You're going to get fit. Where are you going?
Yeah. There's a guy named Mike Burry, who's got a bunch of followers on Instagram and everything. He's here in Dallas, and he's got, I can't think what the name of the place is. Is it Cool Clubs? I shouldn't say that if I don't know what it is. He's got a fitting place here in Dallas that I'm going to go. I'm just wondering if maybe, since I've decided I cannot change my golf swing, I've wondered if maybe it's just getting fit for something.
Yeah, man.
My clubs are a
little more flat, some better shafts.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully. We'll see.
ask about that are kind of trouble holes for, I'd argue, most people. And I've got my three distances. My driver is about 310. My high launch three woods, 270. And I've got a hybrid at 230. And the first hole in question
And what's your handicap?
I'm right at a zero. I've fluctuated between a plus one and a one for about the past year. And so I've got with the driver, I've got the 70-yard dispersion. With the three wood, I got 55. And with the hybrid, I've got about, call it 50 yards, so 48, a little less.
Just for anyone watching, like click on the 270 so you'll see that tree change.
Yeah, the dispersion will go between the yardages here. So with the, this is our first, you know, I like to say every good course has a risk reward par four, right? Like
I agree.
Try and drive it or play it safe. And so this is a decision that you're stuck with from, these are our black tees, three tee box back here. And everybody always asks, do you hit driver here? Do you lay up to the largest part of the fairway, which is actually probably smaller, a shorter club than 230. Could be a four iron or a five iron right to here. And this leaves you about 100 and anywhere between 120 to 140, depending on how well you hit your shot. Just laying up in front of this bunker to the largest part of the fairway, or...
Well, that part right there leaves you 102 from the middle.
Yeah, but I'm saying you'd probably actually go shorter than this.
That's what I'm saying. You would go 20 or 30 yards short of that.
Correct. Yep. You'd go... Yeah, you would be... I don't know. Call it... We'll just say it's 140, depending on where the tee box is.
Yeah.
And then you've got your driver, right? If you try and drive the green, if you hit a really good one, you can get up there, but... You've got to carry this bunker right here, which is at approximately 285, 290. And then this is kind of some fescue off here to the right. The rough is...
Are you going
to
find playable. It in the fescue?
More than half the time, you'll find it. Can you play it? That's a different question. You're not going to have like a super clean lie where you can for sure get on the green. Our fescue is pretty long and rough. It's a links style golf course.
Zoom in just a little bit on this. I don't know if you can, there you go.
Usually the line is at the right bunker. Is what they would tell you from the tee box.
Yeah, that looks correct. I mean, left looks completely dead.
Yeah. So this is water right here. And then this is rough right here. So you would want to put your target right there so that your dispersion runs along this rough line.
This is a perfect example of what I was talking about earlier. This is number three, unfortunately, but if this were number 17 or even 16, this would be a spot where, obviously, or 18, where if you're down, I would tell you to hit driver here because you're going to make significantly more birdies, but you are also for sure going to make bogeys and doubles and everything else. This one, go back to the 230.
And this is, and again, more there. Likely it's probably going to be a 215 shot, probably a, you know,
yeah,
five
iron. I just want to now zoom in here.
This is just standard rough. This is all.
Yeah. I mean, this is all, short of the bunker. If it's just a stroke play, this is, you would probably have to lay this one back to 220 off the tee.
Laying this one up.
Excuse me, 210 off the tee.
And that's what I've started to do, you know, early on when I was still figured out decade and just, you know, trying to learn the system and everything. I hit driver a bunch, and you're right. I did make way more birdies, but I also made way more doubles. So I've started to lay up here, and it's become a pretty easy par because you just have a wedge in, and it's not a terrible green to putt on.
Well, that's the thing that people don't understand is par is literally always a good score. I mean, there's, aside from a few par fives, I mean, just very, very rarely, especially on any par four, is par a bad score. And so, yes, it seems like, man, I want to make some birdies, but like, good luck. I mean, you're going to destroy your stroke play scoring average. You're going to destroy on that hole. So and that's unfortunately, that's then I would say it's not a great hole because if it's like meant to be a drivable hole, but it's really not the play.
I don't think it's meant to be a drivable hole, Scott. It's a pretty skinny, long green, and it makes it pretty difficult to. I mean, I've driven it like twice in the last 3 years that we've played, and I hit driver pretty decent amount, which is why I've now just decided to lay up. But it at least gives you the option. So the other hole that gives me, I think this one just gives me it's a hard tee shot visually because you can't see it from obviously the aerial view here. But when you, this bunker right here on the right is not in play. I mean, it's to call it 250 to carry it, if that. But it's not in play, but you still see it visually to a small fairway. And then you have this bunker on the left that sits right at that, call it 310 mark, 290 to get into it. And so the smallest part of the fairway, if you were to hit your driver, you have to aim over that bunker and you can't see any of this fairway on it. So it makes the fairway look a lot skinnier than it really is. I think, and I'm looking for confirmation, that the play is to hit, you know, a three wood off the tee and still give yourself, what is this, probably six iron in, probably from about 190. But I'm really curious what you would...
Click back to the 310 real quick. So this is what's interesting. So because of the geometry of the hole being a dog leg, going 40 yards further up only makes your second shot 30 yards shorter.
Correct. Yeah. If you're more right, you could actually hit it. Like you can hit it over here and have a pitching wedge. You could hit it over here and have a five iron.
And how bad is the rough? That it doesn't look like this is fescue at all.
So if I zoom in, this is rough. If I go back to driver, this left of the bunker is fescue. This is all rough here.
So in this scenario, the bunker actually acts as a catcher's mitt also, which is nice. It stops most of the left shots from getting to the left fescue, but it looks like the right can be somewhat in play. It looks like the first bunker, based on your saying 270 with three wood, your carry's right in that 250 range, 260 range, 255, 260. So that bunker, if you miss a three wood at all, you're probably not carrying it.
Yeah, that'd be a fair and accurate statement.
And so just on the, is the right side of that bunker, just zoom back in. You don't need to keep zooming out. Is the right side, so see how like the middle, it looks like that's fescue around the middle of the far lip. Is fescue all right of that bunker or if you carry
the... There's fescue on the lip of the bunker here. And I'd say right of it, this is fescue as well. Once you get past the bunker, that's where the rough is. This is all fescue, this kind of light stuff in between the tree, the bunker. This is fescue.
As long as because of conditions, like it's downwind, as long as you're pretty much for sure going to carry that bunker, I would draw back to three wood here.
Okay.
If the bunker, and this is one of those deals that's kind of interesting. It really does work out quite often this way because I would say this is a well-designed hole. It's making it challenging to carry one bunker with a three wood, but you can reach the other bunker with a driver. I would say that if it's downwind, you're easily going to carry the bunker, most likely, with three wood, which also then means you're probably not going to get to the next bunker. The flip side of that is if it's into the wind, you're probably not going to carry the first bunker with three wood, but then you're also probably not going to get to the second bunker.
Yeah.
So that would be...
And more times than not, like the normal wind is probably playing in and off the left slightly. Probably, you know, yeah. 10 to 15 in and off the left.
Yeah. I mean, which would make carrying that thing pretty difficult. So carrying the first bunker with three would, I assume, pretty difficult, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So you just hit driver and
you again, driver.
That's what makes it, you know, cause then your driver ends up right here.
If you which ends up being to the 310 now, because really that's 310 total, but you're probably more in the 300 total range here.
Yeah, right about here, which puts, you know, a quarter of your shots in the bunker.
That's fine because a quarter of your shots with three wood are in the first bunker into the wind. I mean, that's the key. You know, now go back to 270 and just kind of look at the same thing. Like maybe not a quarter, but a whole bunch. If you're not carrying that bunker, a whole bunch of them are in the bunker.
So wind dependent, we like whatever the number is to carry this bunker. If we can do that, great.
Whatever
if we can't,
club is going to carry that bunker. Yeah, whatever club is going to carry that bunker is probably the correct club.
Okay. All right.
And this is where, again, what the thing that I differ from a few of the other companies out there that are trying to, I mean, essentially take my information and create strategy apps. The thing that's different with this is, I try to teach you the logic of why you're making the decisions so you can make the decision on your own in real time based on course conditions of speed, different wind directions. Like every day is different in golf. You need to be able to know how to make these decisions on your own And that's the point of Decade, is to help you make these correct decisions, not have something make them for you, because they're just missing too much information.
Yeah.
And so again, the logic on this one is whatever club carries the first bunker probably stays short of the second bunker.
Yep.
Because if three wood won't carry the first bunker, driver will stay short. If three wood won't carry the first, or shoot, three wood will carry the first bunker, it'll still probably stay short of the next bunker.
Yep. The last one, you're not going to like this whole layout. Is probably the most controversial at our club for a couple of reasons. But let me zoom out real quick and see if I can give you a decent visual. So
you're looking at 18?
Yeah, we're looking at 18. So
go shoot me what the green looks like real quick.
Oh, this can't be right. This must be from the wrong tee box. I'm going to have to change this. Actually, that probably is right. Green is pretty long front to back. Front here, back here. I don't know why our green is brown right now. but front to back, pretty long, but it's kind of skinny. Protected by a bunker on the left, water right.
But it's a three-shot hole, isn't it?
Well, so this here begs the question. So with a 310-yard drive, you can get very aggressive on your line and aim at this right bunker and hit it here to this very large part of the fairway. However, your line from here, you can't see, you probably can't see, Pat. This is all, you're carrying all these trees, all this fescue, all this stuff along the right. So it's a complete blind tee shot to try and figure out your line. Like it's very hard to pick out.
But this is one of the points of Decade and using data. This isn't a blind tee shot. You're looking at it right now. You know the center of your fairway is the left edge of that tree.
Yeah,
this is not a blind tee shot. Again, you don't get to see what you're looking at, but this is just a matter of sucking it up and knowing, like, this is a picture of Earth. It can't be wrong. You know that it's, if you hit it over the left edge of that tree, again, what's your carry, 295?
Yep, exactly.
I mean, the thing I would tell you is it's getting dicey to carry on the right quarter of your shot pattern here is not carrying. So you need to take this further left, first of all. And now that's probably good. And now you're putting some shots in the left fescue, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, this bunker right here, like you said, is kind of going to be that catcher's mitt to catch a few of these that go left. But again, from the tee, this is kind of where I struggle a little bit, Scott, because like from the tee, you can't see any of this. So yeah, let's say, you know, I can go 3 yards left of this tree, but the way this is sloped left to right, which probably helps a little bit. But if you carry any of this bunker right here on the left, this is all fescue.
Yeah.
It's all fescue.
Lost pretty much. I mean, just.
Yeah, it's pretty much lost. And so I'll
click back to 230.
230 makes it a three-shot hole, right? But it's a very easy three-shot hole. So to your point, par is an easy score, right? Like it's 230, and then it's probably a 7-iron and then a flip wedge it.
Yeah. I mean, this is a perfect spot that if you're in match play or a stroke play tournament and you are down, you can get more aggressive off the tee and hit driver. You're going to make materially more birdies. You're basically going all in on your tee shot.
Yeah, it's a first shot. It's definitely a first shot hole.
Yeah, you're just going all in on your tee shot here. So again, I do say quite often, don't try to use game theory while you're out there on the course. But this is game theory. You've decided in advance. You're not changing your strategy. You've got two strategies. I'm down strategy and I'm not down strategy. Again, if we're playing a wolf game, I'd be hitting driver here every single time. I mean, birdies double. And I'm sending driver every time. If I'm playing a stroke play event, I would let my standing in the tournament dictate to some degree what I do. I mean, again, but this is a utopian answer and idea. I would tell you that if you were on the Korn Ferry Tour and you were in third place, to play this as a three-shot hole. But what if I make birdie? Yeah, but what if you make six or seven?
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably not your week to win. Like, it just is what it is. So let's don't throw away very valuable points by going backwards on a hole we don't have to go backwards on. I still can make birdie. And so this is a spot where I doubt your scoring average changes much between driver and 230, but your variance decreases massively with the 230.
Yeah.
And that's what I would be looking for more. But in a club championship where I don't really give a shit if I finish second or third or fifth, I want to win or it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I mean, I would.
Then we're sending it.
Then
we're sending it.
Yeah.
All right.
Farther left than you think. I mean, again, this is where practicing on a driving range. So where's your driving range?
Our driving range is right here. Very big driving range.
Yeah. So what you need to do is lay out a 70-yard wide grid on that thing and then just get really good at hitting balls into that 70-yard grid. And then you just come back here and do the exact same thing. Again, you know from looking at it, if you center your shot pattern just left of the trees, 5 yards left of the trees off of 18T, then you've got the same thing you're working with. This is what, if there's any one thing that I make all the golf course architects mad about, is this idea right here. There is no such thing as a blind hole anymore. You know what's out there. Now it's harder to just step up there and rip it, but also at the end of the day, it shouldn't be. You know what's out there. About 5 yards left of those trees. And that was a joke I used to say all the time. I'm like, there's no such thing as a blind hole. I can tell you from Dallas, the center of your shot pattern is 5 yards left of those trees. Step up there, commit to it, and send it.
Yeah. Well, this is super helpful. I hope, I would love next time you come to Minnesota that you come out and play. We're building another course across the street right now. We're going to have two courses. We're about, 10 minutes away from Hazeltine. So it'll be Windsong North and Windsong South. And
it's a cool looking course. I mean, it looks like a nice place.
Yeah. Yeah. It's beautiful. They play the Gopher Invitational there. I know they were in the running for the BMW. I knew
it sounded familiar. Yeah. I definitely knew. Yeah.
Yeah. You probably have a decent amount of college players, some yardage books and stuff from the course. So next time you're up, we would absolutely love to have you. And of course, appreciate you taking some time early on a Wednesday. So good luck practicing or good luck with the club fitting today. And I'm sure we'll catch up again soon in the future.
Awesome. You got it, buddy. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, Scott. Take it easy.